The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What we need to be thinking about is more of kind of a crash emergency program whereby Taiwan can stock up on the sorts of capabilities that would really give PLA planners and Xi Jinping pause. And so I think that those are the sorts of acquisitions that the United States needs to be encouraging. It probably has to be coupled with more realistic military staff talks, for instance, between the United States and Taiwan to give the Taiwanese leadership some confidence within the confines of our One China policy and our policy of strategic ambiguity that the United States actually would come to Taiwan's assistance if it suffered an unprovoked attack by the PRC. But if we don't push Taiwan pretty hard to load up on the sort of capabilities that would actually make a meaningful difference in a fight with China sometime this decade, we're not helping them and we're not helping ourselves.
I'm Matt Gluck, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 19th, 2022. What is the nature and timescale of U.S. geopolitical competition with China? Which country is stronger in the near term and long term? And what will the answers to these questions mean for Chinese military and political activities over the next 10 years? I sat down with Hal Brands, the Henry A. Kissinger Distinguished Professor of Global Affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Michael Beckley, an Associate Professor of Political Science at Tufts University, to discuss their new book, Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. We discussed the author's argument that China is structurally far weaker than people think, but that this weakness makes China more likely to act aggressively over the next several years. We also discussed the implications of this argument for U.S. policy and to what extent international initiatives that are already underway are responsive to this near-term threat. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 19th, Hal Brands and Michael Beckley on the emerging conflict with China.
Hal and Mike, thanks for joining us. I really enjoyed reading your book. To get started, could one of you describe how the idea for the book emerged and why you decided it was important to write at this time?
So I think the idea emerged actually in a seminar that we were doing over at AEI, where we're both fellows a couple of years ago, and Mike was giving a presentation on an academic paper he had written on what happens when fast-growing great powers slow down and how that tends to make them a bit prickly and dangerous. And it occurred to me at that point that I had actually written something similar on the dangers of a declining China a couple of years before. And so we started swapping emails and decided that we were thinking about a complex problem in the same way, and so tried to craft a book that would bring together some of the things that we both do. And so I'm a historian by trade. I think a lot about the history of great power rivalry. I've studied the Cold War and so on and so forth. Mike is an IR scholar who spent significant time in China. And so we figured we'd put all that together and try to put a little bit of a fresh spin on the let's hyperventilate about China genre of books.
In the book, you outline the historical developments that empowered China and brought us to the current moment where the U.S. now views China as its significant geopolitical competitor. Mike, could you take us through a bit of that history and how we got here?
Sure. So, you know, in the initial stages of the Cold War, China for a time became America's number one enemy because you had direct clashes between the two forces in the Korean War, tremendous hostility. But then obviously in the 1970s, things change when the United States exploits the Sino-Soviet split and is able to really recruit China as a quasi-ally. And so that sort of happy marriage of convenience extends all the way until the end of the Cold War. But really, you know, in 1989, you have the unraveling of the Soviet Empire, and then you have Tiananmen Square and the massacre. And so some people thought, well, maybe this could be the moment when you start to see the United States getting tougher with China, because once the Soviet Union is gone, the whole geopolitical rationale for engaging China can come under question. But I think a few things sort of intervened, and we sketch out some of this history in the book. One is just China was much weaker then. You know, it was often joked that if China tried to invade Taiwan in the 1990s, it would be a million man swim. They just didn't have the capability to really expand militarily. At the same time, China was a huge economic opportunity, you know, with 1.3 billion people, a long coastline in the heart of rising Asia, and a government that is willing to trash the environment and to pave the way for big business to come in. It was just too good of an opportunity. And so American multinationals flooded into China. And so that kind of kicked the can down the road in terms of a strategic reckoning. I think it's interesting to remember that when the George W. Bush administration was coming into office, they initially were talking about China as a strategic competitor, as well as not wanting to do nation building. But then, you know, 9/11 happens, and the United States is catapulted into a series of wars in the Middle East and is actually trying to get Chinese cooperation, one, to get UN Security Council authorization for various military interventions, but second, just so that China's not causing problems in Asia while the United States is bogged down in the Middle East. So there's just a series of events that kind of delayed the reckoning. And it wasn't really until the 2008 financial crisis that a number of things came to fruition that really started to change the debate. And then things, of course, really take off under the Trump presidency, which I think is really the first presidential administration to adopt a sort of neo-containment strategy towards China, to really start turning the screw. So by you know, fits and starts, the United States eventually came around to getting tough with China, but a number of factors intervened along the way.
As I understand it, you believe that many policymakers and other experts have a flawed understanding of the U.S.-China geopolitical competitive relationship. Hal, could you explain what's flawed about the general consensus, how you view the relationship, and how your view of the relationship contextualizes the argument you make in your book?
Yeah, they're basically overbought on the China rise narrative. And so I think the prevailing wisdom is kind of the China is number one wisdom, in a way that's kind of an echo of the Japan is number one wisdom back from the late 80s and early 90s. And it basically runs along these lines, which is that China has experienced breathtaking economic growth, which has underwritten a phenomenal military buildup. There's every reason to expect those trends to continue. And so it's just a matter of time until China passes the United States as the world's leading economy and develops global influence to match. Our argument is that that is basically wrong, that China should be viewed more as a risen or perhaps as a peaking power than as a rising power, because there's simply not much reason to expect the really tremendous economic growth of the three decades after the beginning of the reform and opening period in 1978, 1979. To continue. And in fact, it has already slowed considerably from where it was on the eve of the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008. And there are a variety of reasons why China is going to find it very difficult to achieve the level of growth that the Communist Party wants to achieve in the coming years. Everything from demographic problems. China is going to have a shrinking working age population at the same time it has a mushrooming retirement age population, to a political system that has become increasingly hostile to the dictates of rapid growth, to the fact that the world just is not nearly as welcoming of China's rise as it once was. And so countries around the world, particularly advanced democracies, are taking more and more measures to protect their own economies from predatory Chinese practices and are becoming less welcoming of sort of the unfettered economic integration that was such a powerful stimulant to China's economic rise. Add all that to the fact that China has succeeded in alienating the vast majority of advanced democracies around the world, not just in Asia, but also in Europe and in other places. And you're going to have a country that is facing two big problems. One is going to be economic stagnation in the coming years. The other is going to be strategic encirclement, as more and more countries do more and more to try to protect themselves from Chinese aggression in ways that we're seeing right now through the Quad or AUKUS or other initiatives. And so that's going to make the long-term future look more problematic from China's perspective. We're not forecasting that the regime is going to collapse or that there is going to be a revolution in China. We're forecasting that China is just simply going to have difficulty achieving the strategic goals that it has laid out for itself, which are pretty ambitious. And so as that happens, China may actually become more dangerous. There will be more of a temptation for Chinese leaders, notably Xi Jinping, to make big gambles now to try to achieve things that may not be achievable forever. We go into some detail about what those things may be, everything from the incorporation of Taiwan into the PRC to a variety of other things. But historically, it has been peaking revisionist powers, not rising revisionist powers, that behave most aggressively and most dangerously. And that's what we're worried about in the Chinese case.
So Hal, both of you in your book catalog the history of falling powers acting aggressively, including Germany in the early 1900s and Russia in the current moment. Could you take us through some of those examples and explain why they're so instructive to the current situation?
Sure. So maybe the canonical example here would be Germany on the eve of World War I. There have often been parallels drawn between the Germany-UK relationship in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and the Sino-American relationship today. Interestingly, though, I think the parallel that's most worrying is the fact that Germany was no longer a confident rising power at the time that World War I started. It was a power that understood that its capabilities, at least in relative terms, had peaked and were on the verge of decline. And so Germany, really over the course of a few decades after unification in 1870-71, became an economic heavyweight in Europe. It became the foremost land power on the continent and started developing a navy that was meant to rival Britain's. And particularly after Otto von Bismarck left the scene, after the accession of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the German foreign policy began to evolve in a more aggressive direction. And what happened in response was that Germany found itself encircled. It created, or rather it precipitated the creation, first of an alliance between France and Russia, and then of the Triple Entente involving Britain as well. And by the eve of World War I, largely as a response to Germany's own behavior, its rivals were increasingly arming themselves in ways that were going to make Germany's military advantages disappear. And so both the French and the Russians had major military modernization plans underway. The Germans were particularly worried about the modernization of Russian railroads, that is, that would dramatically shorten the mobilization time required to bring Russian troops to the front. The Royal Navy had made clear that it was not going to be surpassed by the German fleet. And in fact, Germany had essentially lost the naval arms race by that point. And so there emerged more and more of a now or never mentality in Berlin. The Kaiser and some of the military leaders and a few of the civilian leaders around him began to worry that Germany had only a few years left in which to achieve its goals, to achieve preeminent status within Europe and perhaps carve out some of the global gains the German leaders had aspired to. And so it wasn't that Germany sort of intentionally and explicitly resolved to start a global war over nothing. It was that when the July crisis started in 1914 with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, Germany was willing to run some pretty extreme risks. It was knowingly willing to run the risk of a continental war with France and Russia, and was willing to invade Belgium, even though that meant a significant risk of a war with Great Britain, in large part because German policymakers feared that tomorrow would not be better, that the Germany's strategic situation would deteriorate and it would find itself at the mercy of its enemies. And so it's a classic example of how a country that is already strong, as Germany was, but has begun to peak, can make some really rash decisions based on a fear that tomorrow will be worse than today.
You explain in the first chapter that geopolitical conflicts often happen at the intersection of ambition and desperation, both of which you think will drive Chinese governance over the next decade. Mike, could you explain where you see the signs of this ambition and desperation in the current Chinese political climate and why you think these factors will spur aggression in the near future?
Sure. So in terms of the ambition, I think it's pretty clear, not just in what Chinese leaders are saying, but also in what China has been doing. So, you know, Chinese leaders have been saying, we want the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. They've been staking out territorial claims that include not just Hong Kong and Taiwan, but, you know, Austria-sized chunks of Indian-controlled territory, as well as some 80% of the East and South China Seas. They've rolled out an economic policy that looks a lot like imperialism to me, essentially carving out privileged economic zones where, especially through the global South, where countries get hooked on Chinese technology, Chinese companies to build their infrastructure, access to the Chinese market and access to Chinese loans. And at the same time, they've been pioneering a new form of digital authoritarianism that just makes authoritarianism much more efficient and effective. So they've been moving very quickly, but we worry that these sky-high ambitions, which, you know, frankly, go way back. I mean, you can trace the evolution of Chinese leaders thinking of their country as naturally being should be the dominant country in the world, and that this period of Western ascendance is like a jarring aberration. You can trace that way back in Chinese history. But what we worry about today is that those ambitions are going to slam into a number of problems, many of which Hal sketched out earlier with the declining rate of growth and the strategic encirclement. And so now we worry that China is starting to move faster to try to consolidate the gains it already has, to snatch what it can while it still can, and to score near-term victories that can alter the long-term trends and the balance of power. So the most obvious case is Taiwan. I mean, China has been waging the most provocative and sustained show of force in the Taiwan Strait for about a year and a half now. And that obviously has been ramped up to a new level in the wake of Nancy Pelosi's visit. And at the same time, you know, China has, you know, doled out $1 trillion in loans to developing countries that have created relationships of dependency. And so we just look around the world and we see China moving much faster to consolidate these gains than it was in the 1990s and the 2000s when China was, you know, preaching friendship diplomacy and a peaceful rise. Now wolf warrior diplomacy has replaced friendship diplomacy, and China is talking about using economic leverage for coercive purposes. And at the same time, it's gearing up for potential war around its periphery.
You cite evidence in the book that China seeks to dominate the global order, such as its apparent plans to regain territories in the region, the Belt and Road Initiative, and large-scale efforts to achieve technological supremacy. Mike, why are these initiatives signs of precipitous short-term aggression instead of long-term commitments to sustainable growth?
Well, I think in the case of Taiwan, that's the clearest case, because this is an area where, you know, for a long time, China's approach was much more patient and peaceful, basically trying to use economic manifest destiny to essentially absorb Taiwan over time just through economic dependence. But as opinion polls in Taiwan have moved in the opposite direction, you have more and more Taiwanese thinking of themselves as solely Taiwanese. Support for unification is at rock bottom. Support for tepid moves towards something closer to independence have increased. And so China's running out of peaceful options. And I think that's why you see China starting to brandish the military option much more ostentatiously. In the technological sphere, I think, you know, after 2008, China realized that it couldn't really count on easy access to developed country markets in the West. I mean, Beijing suddenly got slapped with thousands of new trade and investment barriers, and you just had a collapse in demand for Chinese exports. And so it was in the early 2010s, you start to see the Chinese say, well, we need a new privileged economic zone, essentially, that will guarantee long-term demand for our exports. It'll help us secure access to natural resources, and also at the same time, pump up our technological capabilities through a major industrial drive. And so the fact that China has just allocated so much money towards something like Belt and Road, something enormously ambitious and is so economically overextended, I think also shows just how quickly and how aggressively they feel China has to move in order to alter some of these longer term trends.
So it seems to me that China will only act aggressively if its leaders actually acknowledge that China is not likely to grow sustainably. And some of the rhetoric in Xi's speeches and other leaders' speeches would indicate that they do see China as able to outpace the United States in the long term. Hal, why do you think the rhetoric in those speeches is not their genuine belief? What evidence do you see of that?
I think you have to read the statements of Chinese leaders carefully. And if you just run the thought experiment, what would happen if Xi Jinping were to say the Chinese economic model is fundamentally unsustainable, my own policies are making it less likely that China will grow at high rates in the coming years, and we're increasingly finding ourselves encircled by countries that we ourselves have antagonized, it probably wouldn't end particularly well for him. And so there is an inbuilt bias against that sort of candid assessment, at least in public, in an autocratic system such as China's. What's interesting, though, is that you actually don't have to dig too deep to find evidence that Chinese leaders have become increasingly anxious about the country's prospects. And so we cite internal speeches that Xi Jinping and other officials have given about the dangers inherent in China's economic situation. There have been reports about internal Chinese Communist Party documents that essentially reveal that China has become more widely loathed internationally than at any time since Tiananmen Square as a result of COVID. You can find relatively hawkish observers within the Chinese foreign policy ecosystem, and including folks with pretty close ties to the PLA or to the diplomatic establishment, pointing out that China has fallen into the trap that has ensnared a number of autocratic great powers over the last 100 years, which is basically to make enemies on all sides, and most damagingly to make an enemy of the United States. And you can see it in the fact that there is just less and less candid reporting allowed in China about the state of the economy today than there was a decade ago, let alone 15 or 20 years ago. And so even though it's difficult to, you know, find a single smoking gun of Xi Jinping and his cronies saying, yes, we are a peaking power, not a rising power, there's actually a great deal of evidence that the Chinese government is viewing developments at home and abroad with a greater sense of alarm.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
You discuss in the book the lessons that the U.S. can learn from the Cold War and reference for strategic insights in particular that should guide policymaking with respect to China over the next decade. Mike, could you describe some of these insights and why they could be so helpful?
I think the first insight is simply that you can't make the perfect the enemy of the good. You know, in the early Cold War, you know, a lot of the things that we take for granted, something like NATO or the Western commercial networks that allow the United States and its allies and their economies to thrive, those things didn't exist. And in fact, most of Eurasia, including key U.S. what would become U.S. allies, were essentially shell-shocked and reduced to rubble in the wake of the Second World War. But at the same time, you have the Soviet military that's deployed across Europe and into parts of Asia. And so the United States policymakers had to move fast. They didn't have a long time to slowly garner America's long-term advantages and invest in long-term R&D and try to build a coalition over time. They basically had to set stuff up really quickly to shore up the situation in Europe and Asia, to make sure that communist parties didn't score massive victories, to make sure that the Soviet Union couldn't expand militarily. And you also have the shock of the Korean War that suddenly the United States has to deal with. And so we go through and explain how a lot of the institutions, even something as big as NATO, essentially gets started, or the Marshall Plan is conceived in just a matter of weeks or months, and then is quickly implemented in an ad hoc fashion that sort of accumulates momentum over time. And so we see the same thing being necessary with China today. You know, we used to think of China as this our competition with China is this 100-year marathon, this new Cold War where each side has decades to marshal its resources and rally a coalition. But we worry that this period of maximum danger in the 2020s means, just like in the early Cold War, the United States needs to basically MacGyver a number of solutions to shore up the military balance in the Taiwan Strait, to prevent China from locking in technological and economic dependence across the global South, and to prevent the spread of digital authoritarianism in ways that'll make it very hard for democracy to ever reemerge in a number of countries around the world.
You claim in the book that the U.S. needs to turn away from trying to make China play by a fair and open economic order. And you say the U.S. should turn to power politics instead. What would that look like? And are alliances like AUKUS and the Quad, are those steps in the right direction? Or do you think that something else needs to happen?
So for about 25 years after the end of the Cold War, I think the U.S. vision was to forge kind of a single, increasingly integrated global economy in which everybody could profitably participate. And the thinking, there was a geopolitical rationale to this, of course. It wasn't simply greed. It was that if you drew China into this system, it would become more mollified because it would achieve wealth and prestige and power within a system that it would have no incentive to disrupt. And perhaps it would evolve in the direction of political liberalism, in the direction of democracy over time, as you built up a middle class that would demand political rights to go along with its economic status. It's been clear for a few years now that that bet has not paid off, that you got a more globally integrated China, but one that was actually increasingly autocratic and increasingly aggressive. And so as a result, the connection between geoeconomics and geopolitics in American policy was kind of severed. You had these things working at cross purposes. So the argument we're making is that you have to align geoeconomics and geopolitics once more. And so what this means is working really hard to cultivate a thriving international economy, but one that is made up mostly of the countries that China threatens, while leaving China on the outside and even selectively trying to weaken its economic capabilities in areas such as 5G telecommunications, for instance, where the United States has actually done precisely this over the last 2 to 3 years. And so instead of thinking about our goal being one of creating a single, seamlessly integrated global order, what we're going to end up with is kind of like a rump liberal order that hopefully will become more and more developed and more cooperative, but will hold China and other aggressive powers on the outside for the foreseeable future. And so it's a shift back towards sort of the two worlds type approach that we saw during the Cold War, as opposed to more of the one world approach that became prevalent after the Cold War ended.
So you describe in the book that many of the countries that would be part of these informal alliances, this rump order, are very dependent on China right now. For example, Chinese consumers buy a very high percentage of German cars, and there are other similar examples. How do you know that those countries will be willing to give up those short-term economic opportunities for this long-term geopolitical prosperity?
I mean, I don't think you know for sure. I think, you know, a few things have made it perhaps more likely. I think for one thing that ironically, Russia's invasion of Ukraine sort of galvanized discussions within the West, because you obviously had collusion in order to sanction Russia. And there was also conversations about, well, what about China? And what are we going to do if China starts becoming more aggressive in East Asia? And so something that looked impossible, you know, Germany becoming a more active member of a Western democratic coalition that's geopolitically on the march looks more likely today than it was, say, 6 months ago. I think another factor is just China has actually been doing some of the hard work for the United States just by being so overtly belligerent, almost to like North Korean style levels of in-your-face hostility, and really shooting itself in the foot in a number of cases. So there's a number of examples we go through in the book. You know, just from 2021, you had you know, China overreact to having sanctions slapped on four officials because of abuses in Xinjiang, and so China countered with a bunch of sanctions on members of the EU Parliament as well as European think tanks, and so then the European Union retaliated by suspending its investment treaty that it was going to have with China. Or if you look at what happened with a country like Australia, which I remember 5 or 6 years ago had this big national debate of should we lean to the American side or should we lean to the Chinese side? Because we depend on the Americans for security, we depend on the Chinese for economics. But, you know, in the wake of COVID, where Australia had the audacity to ask, you know, hey, where did COVID come from? China completely had a wolf warrior meltdown and imposed what is essentially a trade war on Australia, raising tariffs on many of its key exports into China. And in response, you've seen AUKUS emerge from that. You've seen a total reorientation of strategic policy in Australia. So even though it's going to be hard to cobble these things together, I think that there's at least some momentum partially propelled by China the United States still has to do the hard work. But a point we make again in the book is that these coalitions don't necessarily have to be perfect. They don't have to be broadly multilateral. In many cases, like for example, the coalition that is cutting off China from high-end semiconductors basically involves four or five key players. And so you could have a set of mini-lateral coalitions, each focused on particular areas of competition with China, that when you add them all together, form a pretty potent containment barrier against China.
You discuss how Taiwan is a kind of flashpoint in this U.S.-China competition, and that's kind of the focus generally right now among commentators. Taiwan hasn't bolstered its military as much as many might have hoped, and there are no strong indications that it will do so in the next few years. You talk about how the U.S. should incentivize Taiwan to do that and help Taiwan move toward a stronger military posture. What's the likelihood of that happening over the next few years? And what signs should we be looking for to see that progress?
Well, it gets better and better with every crisis that China provokes. And so I think the basic state of play right now is that Taiwan has a pretty smart defense concept. It's relatively new. It was adopted a couple of years ago. And the idea is to use cheap and plentiful capabilities to basically turn China's anti-access area denial strategy against it. You acquire lots of things like anti-ship missiles, sea mines, drones, expendable or attritable ISR, and other relatively cheap capabilities that can have a pretty devastating impact on, say, a Chinese invasion fleet or some other sort of Chinese effort to exert military and political control over Taiwan. And that's a strategy, I think, that has a good chance of succeeding if it is implemented quickly enough, because Taiwan has a lot of natural advantages. You got to cross a lot of choppy water to get from China to Taiwan. There's only a few beaches you can land a sizable invasion force on. Taiwan's terrain is very favorable to the defense. It's got jungle, it's got mountains, it's got crowded urban environments. That's an attacker's nightmare. And so if Taiwan adopts the right strategy, I think it'll be in good shape. The challenge is that it's just not moving particularly quickly to adopt that strategy. And to the Taiwanese military still has a lot of weaknesses. There's still a significant portion of the budget that's spent on, you know, big ships and planes that are likely to be killed on the first day of a war with China. There's not much of a reserve system, although that's changing. There are real questions about how psychologically prepared the Taiwanese population would be for a protracted and potentially quite devastating conflict with China. And the timetable for implementation of Taiwan's defense reforms is still too long. It's still really extending late into this decade and even into the decade that follows, when what we need to be thinking about is more of kind of a crash emergency program whereby Taiwan can stock up on the sorts of capabilities that would really give PLA planners and Xi Jinping pause. And so I think that those are the sorts of acquisitions that the United States needs to be encouraging. It probably has to be coupled with more realistic military staff talks, for instance, between the United States and Taiwan, to give the Taiwanese leadership some confidence within the confines of our One China policy and our policy of strategic ambiguity that the United States actually would come to Taiwan's assistance if it suffered an unprovoked attack by the PRC. But if we don't push Taiwan pretty hard to load up on the sort of capabilities that would actually make a meaningful difference in a fight with China sometime this decade, we're not helping them and we're not helping ourselves.
So the U.S. policy toward the defense of Taiwan has been quite ambiguous, with Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan and at the same time the One China policy. There are kind of a lot of different things moving in different directions. What would you advocate as a specific kind of public policy that the U.S. should state? More of this ambiguity or a stronger defense? What would you advocate in the next year and then maybe over the next 5 years?
I think the United States should talk a lot less and do a lot more. Right now, you kind of have the worst of both worlds because the U.S. is talking very loudly, sending over high-ranking officials, legislation pending on Capitol Hill about either upgrading Taiwan's international status or the U.S. defense commitments to Taiwan. I think all of that is just provoking Beijing into a fight that from a U.S. side will be great to have some extra time to get ready for. So to me, it seems like the United States should almost be doing the opposite of what it's been doing in recent months, which is namely to focus on, first of all of those defense reforms that Hal just spelled out, essentially trying to turn be able to turn the Taiwan Strait into a no man's sea, if you need to be able to sink large numbers of Chinese ships that are either trying to blockade or invade the mainland. I think upgrading Taiwan's status doesn't make sense strategically for the United States, as well as for the Taiwanese, the vast majority of whom are happy with the status quo, where they essentially have de facto independence, and they are willing to live with the fact that it's not official if it means it reduces the likelihood of a Chinese assault on their nation. So to me, that seems like the best policy. To talk softly and carry a big stick, that's usually good advice. I think it's excellent advice on the Taiwan Strait today.
In your last chapter, you discuss how the global order might look if the U.S. were to succeed in maintaining control of geopolitics and democracy were to win out over authoritarianism over the next decade. And you talk about how even this victory will present difficulties. Hal, could you lay out this picture?
It's not a super pretty picture, at least compared to what we might have hoped for a decade or 25 years ago. I think it's inevitable that the United States is going to be dealing with a powerful and problematic China for a long time to come. When we talk about a peaking China, we're not talking about a China whose power is about to fall off a cliff and cease becoming a problem for the United States. As Adam Smith said, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. And so you could have a China whose economy has stagnated that continues to raise challenges for the international order, for the United States, for its allies, for many, many years beyond the 2020s. And so what we're probably looking at in a good case scenario is that you have sort of rival spheres of influence or rival geopolitical blocks, one that is made up of the United States and most of the world's advanced democracies, along with some developing democracies and friendly autocratic regimes, and one that is led by China and may include Russia, it may include Iran, it may include some other developing countries around the globe. The United States is not going to be successful at totally constricting the spread of Chinese influence in this decade or any other. And so our goal ought to be for the U.S. bloc, basically, the U.S. Crew in international politics to be larger, stronger, and more influential than China's. I think that is eminently doable. If you look at things like shares of global GDP, shares of global military spending, the U.S. just plus its formal democratic treaty allies in Europe and the Asia Pacific significantly outweighs China, China plus Russia, China plus Russia plus any other combination you can think of. And so I think that is a doable objective. What we have to realize, though, is that is still going to be an international system that is fraught with tension for some time to come. The Cold War parallel is relevant here. The most dangerous period of the Cold War was really the first 15 years of that struggle, from the late 1940s through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s. But it wasn't as though the Cold War ended after that. You had another 25 years of geopolitical rivalry, and it was only resolved in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And during that time, you had a very divided international world economically, geopolitically, militarily. I think, unfortunately, that's probably what we're looking at in the coming decades. And so our goal shouldn't be perfection, as Mike said earlier. It should be a good enough global system where the United States and its friends can hold their own vis-a-vis their challengers.
So it kind of seems like we've, at least according to your view, we've crossed the point where we could have had this global order that is all kind of cooperative. We're now in this bipolar or moving toward a bipolar space between democracy and authoritarianism. What lessons can be learned from reaching this point for the next century in geopolitics? Why are we at this point where we can't have more cooperation?
You know, I think the trouble starts, in my mind anyway, around the 2008 financial crisis, because then you had the United States suddenly become much more paranoid about its own decline, just given the economic crisis. And you had China sort of on the one hand being cocky abroad in the sense that they looked at the American model and said, well, that clearly isn't the way to go. But at the same time, it confronted China with a number of economic and strategic pressures, namely the collapse of its export markets abroad in developed countries, just a more hostile environment. And so each country starts to kind of go its own way at that point. And we've seen this in history. You know, when economic times get tough and geopolitical tensions start to rise, you really start to see competition among the top great powers increase. So I think you start to see a number of developments over those years. And then, of course, as the United States starts to withdraw from the Middle East, it starts being able to focus more on its geopolitical rival, who all the while is engaged in everything from the largest military buildup we've seen in peacetime in at least a generation, this unprecedented lending surge that turned China into the world's banker in many respects, and new competition over new technologies that a lot of people are saying could revolutionize how economies are run, but also how militaries compete and how nations deal with each other. So if one country can dominate artificial intelligence, that's going to give it a huge leg up. So there were just a number of factors that really contributed to heightened geopolitical tensions that may honestly have been inevitable, just that you have an anarchic system, you have the two most powerful countries with overlapping spheres of influence and in many ways incompatible regime types and ideologies, and therefore want to see a fundamentally different kind of world emerge. So maybe some of this was inevitable. I don't think you can blame the United States too much, given that I really think the United States tried very hard to cajole China to become a reluctant, if not responsible, stakeholder in the existing system. But you can also understand it from China's perspective that that system, of course, they didn't have a hand in writing. That system certainly privileges democratic governments and those that are going to be more willing to open up both their political systems and economies. And that system has been in the past deadly for authoritarian regimes, particularly of the communist bent. They can look at the Soviets, the Eastern Europeans, as well as various color revolutions. And to them, they see this world as an unacceptable and potentially hostile one for the rule of the CCP. So I think there's just, you know, some people say this whole rivalry between the United States and China is like a big misunderstanding. It's a security dilemma. I personally don't subscribe to that. To me, it just seems like the two countries understand each other pretty well, and they dislike what they see for pretty good reasons, because a lot of the main issues in this relationship are zero sum at their base. Taiwan can either be ruled from Beijing or from Taipei. The South China Sea can either be an international waterway or it can be Chinese territorial waters. The internet can either be a big open space where the information flows freely, or it can be censored into oblivion and controlled by states. I mean, just across, you know, 5G technology, like you can either use Huawei or you can use some American selected alternative, right? So there's just so many issues that at their nature are zero sum. And I think that has pushed us to this point where we are now saying, well, maybe the best way to deal with this is to, for at least a while, have sort of two worlds and at least secure an American-led side of the world, and then try to come back from a position of strength and come back to the table with the Chinese in the long run. But in the short run, it just doesn't look like there's much space for compromise.
Okay, we will leave it there. Hal Brands, Mike Beckley, thank you for joining us in the Lawfare podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Jay Venables of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.